After the Rath Yatra, I went down to Los Angeles for my initiation ceremony there. And I was always, you know, even right up to the end, I always felt very nervous in Prabhupada's association, because I always just felt he could understand my thoughts and see my heart and everything. But whatever. When it came time for me to come up and get my beads, Prabhupada said, I walked up to the Vyasa-san and offered my obeisances. And as I was starting to offer my obeisances, he said, "So, you are brahmachari?" You know. But I was just so nervous, I didn't know what to do, so I just continued offering my obeisances. And so someone was trying to tell me, "Prabhupada's talking to you, Prabhupada's talking to you," but I just kept offering what I wanted to avoid. Because he was like God, you know, to me. It was like he's come to save me, and it was a relief, a relief of a huge burden. I mean, in the material world, I was in such material anxiety, and Prabhupada had relieved my burden, and he was so beautiful, and so I was very shy. So, but then afterwards, it kind of struck me that maybe he's given me a blessing that I'm a brahmachari. And by Krishna's grace, I never got married, and yeah, here I am, struggling.
I was contemplating, you know, because I had this thing in my mind that I hope I have a good name. It was very important to me, the name that I, because I, you know, there, I so far had liked everyone's name that I had met as initiated devotees, but I was worried that I would get a name that just didn't sound right, you know, that wasn't me, or but I knew that I had to accept it, because it was obviously, because Prabhupada knew what my spiritual name was, so he was going to call me by that name. So it was just a struggle going on inside my, you know, completely on a superficial platform. It had nothing to do with the, it was just distraction. My mind was just distracting me from, but I had some significance, I knew, so I dwelled on it as long as I needed to. And I was thinking, the name, I was attracted to a particular name. I thought, well, maybe I'll get that name. This is a good name. I like the sound of that name. And the name was Madan Mohan. Madan Mohan. I kept saying Madan Mohan. Boy, that's a good name. I hope I can get that name. Obviously, totally whimsical. So, a few days passed. The time for initiation came. In the meantime, I had gotten some ready-made beads, which these beads I had with me, and I had actually already been, I had been using them because I had been in a temple for about 6 months in Montreal. So these were my beads. So I brought them with me to the yagya, to the initiation. And it was a beautiful scene, of course. I had never witnessed so much grandeur and so much effortless grace, all in such a small, you know, small space, and there's such simple gestures. It was a wonderful experience. But so during this, Prabhupada would, you know, take the beads from somebody, then chant on them, then return them. When it came my turn, I hand him my beads. So he takes my beads, and they were like, they're not overly small, they were like the same size that most other beads were. But they were, you know, on the small side, so I hand him the beads, and he takes them, and he looks at them with disapproval. He says, "You couldn't have gotten bigger beads?" And at that moment, I'm thinking, beads, you know? And I'm like, all of a sudden, I'm already being, you know, I'm demolished, you know? I have no land to stand on. I'm just like this. I didn't know what to say. So I'm quiet. I don't know. I think I shrugged. And he took the bead, you know, and he chanted. And while he was chanting, I'm thinking, Madan Mohan, Madan Mohan. And that's, you know, the mind is just going on. I mean, it was like on hold. Waiting. Finally, he begins chanting. He hands me the beads. And before I take them, he says, Is there already someone named Madan Mohan? And then all the devotees are going, oh yes, yes, Prabhupada. Here he is. And then with that, there's not a split second even. Your name is Bharadraj. Chant 16.
I was invited to come up to his room to receive the Brahminical initiation, the Gayatri Mantra. So I was really excited, and I walked into the room, and I gave my obeisances, and then Prabhupada motioned to me, he said, come closer. So I went close as I thought I should be, and then he said, come closer. So I sat right next to him, he made me sit right next to him. And then he gave me a piece of paper to look at with the Gayatri Mantra on it. And then he said, come a little closer, and then he began to repeat the words of the mantra, sort of, you know, close to my ear. So I was very excited. We were alone in the room, and it was very intimate. So after that, I was going to leave the next morning. So he began to speak to me a little bit. He said, so you are leaving? And I said, yes, Prabhupada. And he said, so you are going by Calais. So I was wondering, why is he saying this? You know, I mean, how does he even know about Calais? Calais is a port on the French coast, North Sea coast. And I was going from Dover to Boulogne. So I said, no, Prabhupada, not Calais. The hovercraft doesn't go from where I get from Dover to Calais. He said, you are sure? I said, yes, Prabhupada, you're wrong. Then I realized what I was saying. I was telling Prabhupada he's wrong, you know. And I felt inside I shouldn't say that, you know. So he just looked at me and smiled. I said, that's all right. He said, so thank you very much. And then I gave my obeisances. And Om Agyanya Timurandasya. And then he said, thank you very much. You know, you continue, pursuing the work in Paris. So I went. So when I got to Dover, I kept thinking in my mind, why did I say no to Prabhupada? I should just not have said anything, you know. So when I get to Dover, there's an announcement. Ladies and gentlemen, due to rough seas today, the hovercraft will not be going to Boulogne. So I heard that, you know, like, I was like a little bit surprised. Exceptionally, the hovercraft will be going to Calais today. So I said, oh no, I said, what a fool I am. You know, Prabhupada asked me, you know, are you sure? You know, and I kept insisting, yes, I'm sure. So I remember that very vividly, you know.
We had been apprised of the rules and regulations. He didn't go through it. He just said, chant 16 rounds, and Krishna consciousness means happiness, which he had said many other times over the years. Krishna consciousness means happiness, which was a very, very strong thing. Prabhupada sometimes gave very nice short instructions. We were in Nandagram looking at the paintings and the art, and it was beautiful, and he turns to me and says, art means full belly. Very poignant, very short, very sweet, and full bit of philosophy. He said, if someone is hungry, they cannot think about making or looking at art. They're thinking about filling their bellies. So the Krishna consciousness means happiness was very powerful through the years. And he said it at the initiation.
Prabhupada was in Los Angeles and we were doing well, distributing lots of books, so we thought we'd go and see Prabhupada and tell him about it. And all of us, I got this idea that we should memorize a verse in Sanskrit, because not many people were into Sanskrit at that time. I thought we should offer a prayer to him. So we came in to see Srila Prabhupada about lunchtime, and we offered him this prayer, Tvam Nasan Darsito Dushtaram Nistitir Satam Kalang Satvarham Harang Pung Sankarnadara Ibarnabham, that we think that your goodness is met by us by the will of providence, just to accept you as the captain of the ship. So, again, it was funny, I don't know. Krishna's already, I curse myself now, but Prabhupada asked us to take lunch with him. And I thought, no, we want to get back out and distribute more books, Prabhupada. So we missed another opportunity.
My marriage was opposed by my parents. They were horrified at the idea that I was going to marry the movement. You know, they refused to come to attend. And my mother had sent a telegram to Prabhupada that I had a history of mental illness. Totally untrue. Or maybe true, but not to my knowledge. She was very angry and wrote a very angry letter to Prabhupada saying, a telegram actually, this was the day before marriage, I didn't see the telegram, but I heard about it. Prabhupada called me in. This is my second interview with Prabhupada. Called me in, and right away, he said, I received the telegram from your mother. She says, you are crazy. Is this true? I thought about it, and I thought, no. I said, I don't think so. Srila Prabhupada. But I suspect that she might be. Which was not a proper thing to say about one's mother in front of Prabhupada. Prabhupada never tolerated, generally did not tolerate disrespect to one's parents. There are other stories, but they're not my stories, so I mean. But I know there's a story about Brahmananda where he was made to bow down to his mother in front of Prabhupada, which is an interesting story, and there were others. But I had shown that kind of independence in front of Prabhupada. I wanted him to know that my mind was set, that, you know, that actually this whole process was a way of, you know, of cutting the bonds of, you know, the family, the worldly family influence that might be there to stop me from doing that, which I know I should wholeheartedly do, being guided by his wisdom and his kindness. So I said, but I think she might be. And I actually, you know, believed it. He laughed. Very, you know, just a very hearty, heart-filled laugh. He said, but that's all right. He said, if anyone asks, he said, I have not received this telegram.
Before the press conference, Prabhupada was speaking to the devotees. There were about 30 people there, I think. Most of us were very young. There were a lot of young kids there, maybe 17, 18 years old. So I arrived after everything was in process, when I walked in, I had the illusion that, you know, well, you know, I organized this thing, this is Prabhupada. So I sort of made everyone move out of the way, and I went right up to the front. I came with another devotee named Ganeshyama, who sat, you know, in the entrance, near the entrance, you know, very humbly, quietly. And I went right up, right near Prabhupada, and I sat down right next to him. And then there was one devotee named Lochananda. He was introducing everyone. He said, oh, and this is Hari Vilas Prabhupada, the president of the temple. So Prabhupada didn't look at me. And right away, I felt bad. I said, why didn't he look at me? He mentioned my name. He didn't say anything. Didn't even look, didn't even nod. So I realized I must have done something wrong. And I was feeling bad that I pushed everyone out of the way to go sit up front. So, Lochananda said, and that's Ganeshyama in the back. He's the one that translating your books. Prabhupada said, oh, where is he? Let him stand up. So, Ganeshyama stood up and he said, thank you very much. You know, so now I knew I had done something wrong. You know, and I realized I must have been puffed up that, you know, why he didn't even look at me and he's acknowledging Ganeshyama. So then, they kept speaking a little more, and Prabhupada was thanking the devotees for participating in Krishna consciousness. Then he, finally, there was news that we had just got a new temple. This was a major accomplishment. And Prabhupada said, where is it? And Lord Chanan said, it's a little bit out of town. So Prabhupada looked at me for the first time, and his look was very weighty, and I could barely look at him. You know, I felt, you know, very, puffed up, you know, and he had already put me down in a sense, and I was feeling very contrite about it. And then he said, so how far is the temple from Paris? So that question sort of shocked me. It took me off balance. And I was thinking, well, it's not very far, Prabhupada. He said, oh, how far is it by car? I said, well, I'd say it's about 45 minutes. He said, oh, and by train? And then I was thinking, wow, you know, why is he asking me these questions? And I was all confused. I said, oh, it's over an hour. He said, oh, so it's very far. I said, yes, Prabhupada, it's very far. Then I realized, you know, my guru was correcting my imperfect intelligence and my illusions about myself. And I realized why I had accepted him as my spiritual master, because he was able to point out these things in a very, you know, let's say, precise way. And I needed that. So I was very happy, humbled, but very happy at that time.
First Kumbh Mela, we were there. We're in a grand tent. It looked like a nomadic Bedouin tent. It was very large. Prabhupada was in there. We were all gathered, not all, but the so-called big guns, the people that... Again, it wasn't because he loved us more. It was because we were doing something, and it was reciprocation. Parenthetically, because before I forget it, we were on a train, and Prabhupada said, I do not love any devotee more than the other, just like Krishna rains on the ocean. His mercy is throughout. Well, similarly, he said, Krishna loves all his devotees equally, but if someone steps towards him, he will reciprocate. He will show that love. So Prabhupada was showing great love to the people who were doing something. So the so-called leaders were there. And he asked us, how do you know Krishna is God? So somebody says, because it says so in the Bhagavad Gita. And Prabhupada says, someone can say that is just a book. And I said, because you say so, Prabhupada. He says, I am just old man. Someone will say, what does he know? He is old man. So we didn't know. So Prabhupada said, the answer is because you feel the ecstasy. You feel the bliss. You feel the nectar. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. And I thought, what a great answer, because I had many times felt the ecstasies. That's what kept me going. And Prabhupada, I was scholarly, but really my Krishna consciousness from the very beginning was interacting with Prabhupada.
So Prabhupada had asked me to create some sample. He didn't say sample. He said, can you draw a picture of Lord Chaitanya? Obviously, he wanted to see. So a few days later, after the marriage, and my wife, Rukmini, had brought in her paintings, and other paintings were there, Jarani's paintings. And Prabhupada would look at everything. And I did this drawing of Lord Chaitanya, which was not in retrospect. It was, you know, it was such a struggle. I did it in, you know, in an afternoon or whatever. I had some time and I devoted some time to it. But I thought, well, it was not finished. The figure of Lord Chaitanya was there, but everything else was just barely sketched in. But I'd put in, you know, everything I had into Lord Chaitanya's face and his expression and his attitude, whatever I understood to be right, to be put into the picture. And Prabhupada looked at other pieces of art, and mine was rolled up on the desk in front of him. And he looked at Rukmini's painting, and he appreciated it, and he said, that's nice. Or I don't know if he said anything at all. He was appreciating it. And then he noticed that there was this rolled up paper in front of him on the desk. And He said, what is this? And someone said, it's a drawing by Bharadwaj. And Prabhupada took it and he unrolled it. And as he was unrolling it from the top, I could see that he was looking, that the first thing he saw was Lord Chaitanya's face. And as soon as he got to it, his eyes got big, really big. You know, and Prabhupada's eyes were big to start with, but whenever he got excited about something, they'd like really, really expand. And then he unrolled some more, and then he got to the rest, and then he finally, when he unrolled the whole picture, he had the biggest grin on his face. I mean, his face was just expanding, and his teeth were just showing. It was like his whole face became like a sun, you know. It was like he was shooting his rays, and he was looking at it and said, "Ah," he said, "the husband is better."
After the press conference finished, an introduction to the devotees, I ordered a taxi, and then we got in a taxi. Myself, Prabhupada, Aravinda, and Shyam Sundar. And I was sitting on the left-hand side in the back seat. Prabhupada was sitting in the middle, and Aravinda was sitting on the right-hand side. So we started driving through the center of Paris. We went to a major place or crossroads called Le Concord, which is a very, very prestigious place in Paris, and there you can see the Champs-Élysées going up to the Arc de Triomphe, Arc de Triomphe, and the obelisque, the Egyptian, Egyptian form that was brought to France by Napoleon. So at that time, Prabhupada asked me. At that time, I asked Prabhupada a question. Because I was always reading the Bhagavad Gita, and I was always writing down questions. If ever I would meet Prabhupada, I would ask him. So there was a lot of traffic. We were stuck in the traffic. And I asked the Prabhupada, I said, "Prabhupada, what does this verse mean?" And the verse was that, Yanisa Sabhabhutana, what is time of awakening for massive man is nighttime for the sage, and what's time of awakening for the sage is nighttime for the massive man. So I asked him, what does this verse mean? So he didn't, there was noise. So he said, what is that? And then Aravinda said, what does this verse mean? And Prabhupada said, oh yes, he says, he heard time of awakening. What does this verse mean? Prabhupada said, yes. He said, 4 o'clock. He said, all our devotees wake up 4 o'clock. And they take shower and go to Mangal Arati. So I said, I looked at Aravinda, and then he smiled. And he said, no, Prabhupada, what does this verse mean? Yanisa Sarvabhutana. And Prabhupada started to smile. And he said, yes, he said, this means that when we see the karmis, we laugh. And when the karmis see us, they laugh. But our laugh is better. He said, we know that they are wrong. He said, they see us, and they think that we're wasting our time chanting Hare Krishna. We see them, we know they're wasting their time in material life, but our laugh is best.
Well, the first exhibit was completed miraculously in Prabhupada, and it was that year when all the devotees, the first time devotees came out in droves for the Gauranga festival, and it was a wonderful year, and Prabhupada came, and lo and behold, we actually completed an exhibit which was arranged in a kind of a horseshoe in front of the incomplete Mayapur temple at the time. So everything was like that, shacks, you know. The exhibits were made in these bamboo shacks, and everything was like just barely kept together with some cow dung and arrowroot and twine. And but I thought, you know, to this day, I think those are the most wonderful exhibits that we had created. There was such vibrant, raw energy, real wonderful. And so we started. At one end. We actually started somehow. I wasn't there. I missed the beginning. I was, you know, preparing something and getting things ready. And the tour, Prabhupada's tour, had started. It was his first time of seeing the exhibit. And all these devotees were there. So I'm running, you know, to try to catch up. And so they started it backwards, started at the wrong end. and going backwards from the end to the beginning. The beginning exhibit was my work, and one of the end exhibits was Rukmini's work. Not the end exhibit, but one of the last ones. And after the first or last exhibit, Prabhupada moved on, and he came to the exhibit that Rukmini had done, which was wonderful. It showed there were these. It was an exhibit of Lord Chaitanya in fainting ecstasy in front of the Jagannath Murti, Jagannath, Subhadra, and Balaram. And Lord Chaitanya was in his, like a stick, in his transcendental ecstatic condition. And Prabhupada looked at it, and you could tell he was drinking the nectar and that he was affected by it very much. And he said, "Who has made this?" And by that time I had caught up, you know, with the procession, and I said, "Rukmini, my wife, has made this," Prabhupada said. "Very, very good." So then slowly moved on to the next thing, came around, and finally came to the last exhibit, which is my exhibit. And it was an exhibit of Prahlad, of Nrisingadev, tearing Hiranyakashipu, and Prahlad standing there and offering him prayers. I think a picture of that exhibit actually made it into the songbook, one of the early publications. And Prabhupada looked at it and said, "Well, who has made this?" I said, "This is my work, Srila Prabhupada." He said, "You still have some learning to do." He said, "This is not yet perfect. The wife is better, I think."
So we're back in the tent in the Kumbh Mela, and so Prabhupada says, "You know Krishna is God by the ecstasy. The proof of the pudding is in the eating." So many, many years later, I'm talking about 7 or 8 years later, we're in Philadelphia on a morning walk. Prabhupada says, he stops, everybody stops. "How do we know Krishna is God?" So I let a few people say this and that, and nobody knew. I said, "Because we feel the ecstasy, we feel the nectar. The proof of the pudding is in the eating." He says, "No, because the Bhagavad Gita says it." So I said, "But Prabhupada, you said..." And by that time, he's down the way he's walking. So it was one of those seeming contradictions that didn't contradict, because it's transcendental.
At one stage, we literally had no manpower, because Western devotees, somehow I never got sick in India, whereas everybody else, you know, would go fat and come back skinny. I went skinny and came back fat. But in Bombay, there were very few devotees at Hare Krishna Land. There was a lot of work to do, and Tamal Krishna, who was the GBC, was discussing with Prabhupada what to do. And I was just a brahmachari, an insignificant brahmachari. I was, you know, doing a little preaching, going out on life membership. And so for some reason or another, Prabhupada called me into his room when Tamal was there, and you know, asked me, "Sridhar, what should we do? What can we do? These are the problems he's asking me." I was flabbergasted. I thought, "Well, I'll try to work harder, Prabhupada." I didn't know what to say. So it was bewildering.
So when Prabhupada walked in, immediately he wanted to have darshan. It was just a Guru Granga altar. We had a picture of the Panchatattva. So he walked into the temple, and I was very, like, a little tense. I didn't know what was going to happen, if he'd approve. It was so simple. And he looked, and he said, "Oh, my Guru Maharaj is here." And he gave his dandabhats. So that that really impressed me. Because, you know, here was Prabhupada. This is only 1970, but still, such a great personality, and he's giving his dandabhats to this very, let's say, humble altar. So that was like wonderful.
He said, an artist worships Krishna by his intelligence. So that very, so just sitting and thinking of Krishna intelligently making decisions how to portray Krishna, that is engaging one's intelligence in worship. And by doing so, then Krishna reveals himself.
The communist thing is going on in Calcutta at the time. They were bombing in North Calcutta. There were some seats for life members, a rupee each. Some communists came, and they say to me that this is distinction. Those seats are for a rupee, and some people might want to sit in those seats, and they can't pay a rupee. I said, well, those are, some people are life members, and they want to sit in seats, so we're making that option. They were complaining, so I said, well, go sit in the seats. If there's distinction and you like the seats, go sit in the seats. But previous to that, they did, and they were satisfied with that. It kind of diffused it. But previous to that, they had sent up a chit, a piece of paper on the stage that said, quit or die, to Prabhupada, quit or die, which was their language. It's like, quit India or die. Does this sound all right? Quit India or die. Prabhupada starts out with the Brahma Samhita prayers. They're so beautiful. It just soothed everybody.
There were 2,000 people, and there were some hecklers there. And we were worried. There was like some anarchists and communists and, you know, young kids, but they were like a large group of them. So when Prabhupada first began to speak, he was sitting on a wonderful throne, Vyasasana, that was built for him. And very impressive. So people were heckling. They're saying, on the floor, on the floor, on the floor. So Prabhupada asked the translator, Jyotimai, he said, what are they saying? And she said, Prabhupada, they're saying you should sit on the floor. So there was a moment of silence. And then Prabhupada looked at, you know, especially the hecklers, that they're part of the audience. And he said, if someone is qualified, they can sit on the seat. This seat does not belong to me. It is the seat of Vyas. Whoever is qualified can sit here. Whoever is qualified in speaking the Bhagavad philosophy can sit here. He said, but if you can hear me better, I will sit on the floor. Now, something happened. When he said that, and it was translated, it was like the weight of that statement was enough to stop them. After that, they remained quiet and respectfully listened to Prabhupada. You know, it's just the way he said it. If you can hear me better, he said, I will sit on the floor.
I know in India I had an opportunity to see how he really expected a lot from them, from Indians, and he encouraged them a lot. And it was almost, because the type of Indians that he attracted were always very, very high class people. I mean, big industrialists, and not only big industrialists with money, but people who had principle, people who were, if not Vaishnavas, a mixture, like Dr. Patel, for example. That was the most amazing friendship or association or whatever you want to call it. And I saw so many occasions where Prabhupada was very, very intimate with Dr. Patel, almost like a friend. He let him get away with virtual murder in terms of Dr. Patel's attitude and challenging Prabhupada and joking with Prabhupada. But I did see, and it imbued in me that vision also, that if Indians would just take up Krishna consciousness and pursue it the way Prabhupada was doing, that it would be a great addition to Lord Chaitanya's thrust in the Sankirtan movement. He really wanted Indians to get involved, and just the way he was very charming. He was very respectful towards them. At the same time, he wouldn't let them speak nonsense, but it was almost like so much respect and love involved that they they appreciated being chastised by Prabhupada, and he often said, I can do, you cannot.
Prabhupada starts out with the Brahma Samhita prayers. They're so beautiful. It just soothed everybody. Pishima comes up on the stage, and she had a following of mostly ladies from Bengal, and they were all, since she was at the front of the stage, or they were going up, we just finished the Brahma Samhita prayers, ready to start the program, and we hear all this noise. And they're talking, and da-da-da, and then some men get up and say, shut up, and they're making more noise than the original noisemakers. So Prabhupada calls me over and said, what's going on? I said, Pishima is trying to get your attention. See, that's an off-the-wall thing. He looks at me, you know, like, we've got a program to do here, so what is going on? I said, some disciples and well-wishers of Pishima are there, and so they're making noise. He says, get them to stop. So I went there, and as nice as I could, I said, we've got to stop, and it subsided in about 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. So I went to Prabhupada, I said, okay. He said, I used to beat her up, and I still shall.
This Prabhupada was talking about qualifications, a man's qualifications, and how hard it is to judge, and that it is almost a gift to judge another man's qualities. It isn't a matter of just comparing one man to another, or going by some standard socioeconomic, you know, worth. And he said my grandmother was expert at this. And she was a simple woman, not educated. But everyone respected her opinions. He said, I'm trying to remember whether it was his sister, I think it might have been his sister, who, there were a number of boys who were, you know, who were applying for the honor of her hand. But it had to go through the grandmother. She was like, she was the one who decided who was worthy and who was not worthy. So, you know, so this young man was there, and he was, you know, well educated, and she was like drilling him, you know. He was educated and came from a good family. He had, you know, there was money, and he was just, you know, a gem of a person, upstanding and so on. And then she said, can you ride a bicycle? He said, oh no, I never learned. And he was a young man in his, I guess, early 20s. She said, so she didn't say anything. There was one of the questions she asked him. And afterwards, you know, so they came and said, well, what do you think? She said, he's worthless. And I was in shock, you know. She said, he has no drive. He said, any boy, when he sees any young boy has an opportunity to learn to ride a bicycle, he will get on, even if it's not his own. He'll, you know, some are friends. He will get on and try to learn. Who has any kind of drive? He said, he has no drive. He's worthless.
So that night, about 12 o'clock, we're waiting outside the Olympia Theater to get a taxi, because we were so poor, we didn't have a car. We didn't have anything, you know. We had just barely gotten into that house. So as we were waiting near an outdoor cafe, I asked Prabhupada, I said, Prabhupada, I know you're tired. Would you like to sit down here? So he just looked at the chair, and he looked at the place and said, what is this place? I said, Prabhupada, this is an outdoor cafe. Cafe? They are drinking and smoking here? I said, yes, Prabhupada. He said, Guru cannot sit in such a place. So I felt, wow, I said, this is amazing. Every time I talk to Prabhupada, he instructs me about Krishna consciousness. Like, it was very, very, like, wonderful. So I said, okay, Prabhupada, I'm sorry. I thought maybe you were tired. He said, that's all right. He said, Guru cannot sit in such a place. So the taxi came, we went back. So on the way back, I asked Shyam Sundar, I said, you know, it's 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, should we get up in time for Mangal Arati? He said, well, devotees should sleep 6 hours. So you just sleep 6 hours, you can get up. I said, is that all right? He said, yes, that's okay. So with that understanding, we took rest. So at 4:35 in the morning, someone is, you know, like pounding my arms. Get up, you nonsense, get up. And I woke up, you know, it was like from a bad dream. I said, what's the matter? He said, you nonsense, Prabhupada is so angry. I said, why? What happened? He said, because there's no Mangal Arati, the devotees aren't up. I said, oh my God. You know, I was really like confused, you know. So I ran downstairs and some devotees had just started, you know, doing a kirtan. And everyone was looking at me with dirty looks. And why did you let this happen? You know, I tried to explain, but then I just kept quiet, you know. I didn't say anything. And then someone grabbed me and said, come on, hurry up. I said, what's the matter? I said, we just started Mangal Arati. Prabhupada wants you to come on a morning walk. So I went outside and there was Prabhupada waiting. And we started walking. So that was wonderful. All of a sudden, we're in the fresh air. It's about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. It's a very nice spring day. And at that time, Prabhupada started speaking, and he said, Shyam Sundar, why are the grihasthas in Maya? He said, why are all the grihasthas in Maya? So Shyam Sundar, he didn't say anything. And then Prabhupada stopped, and he looked at us, and he smiled. He said, because that is their position.
He did describe sometimes what it was like to be on the coming here to the United States, that it wasn't all easy for him. He not only was he sick and he had to cook for himself and he felt out of place, but that even after he got here, at first he had some doubts. And the way he would counteract the doubts is to go to the shipping line and find out the times when the ships would return to India. And the customs guy, the customs man said, Swamiji, you have been coming here for a year and looking at the times, but when are you going? And he would say that.
Then he said, when I first came to America, my plan was just to make sannyasis. And he looked at us. We were all quiet. And then he said, but that is not possible. Then I was thinking, let them get married. Husband gives wife one child. Wife goes to Vrindavan, husband takes sannyas. Then he looked at us again. He said, but that's not possible. So that's all right. You can chant Hare Krishna. So we were all like in a state of shock. So then we kept walking, and then Prabhupada said, he stopped and he looked at the house. He said, this house is first class. And he looked at the fence, and he said, in India, only the best gentlemen have house like this. With this, you know, it wasn't a fence, it was a iron fence, you know, nicely painted and everything. And he said, and look inside at the garden, it's perfect. And look at the house, it's perfect. So he said, it's too perfect. So, you know, I was shocked when he said that. He says, it's too perfect because the gentleman in this house cannot leave the situation. When he dies, he will take birth again. And he'll take birth as a dog or a bug to continue his attachment. Then he said, Griha Chetra Sutapta Griha Chetra Sutapta Vitar Janasi Mohayam Ahamameti. He said, it's too nice and he will continue his attachment. He said, this is the flaw of materialism.
So, you know, we went on, many things were discussed, and, you know, here I'm living with a head full of ideas and charged with a dozen of projects, And I just arrived, you know, I'm sort of like, I'm totally overwhelmed. I walked out and, you know, the first person I saw is like almost the first person I knew from America that I had hadn't seen for a long time. It was Devananda, who was at that time already initiated as a sannyasin, Devananda Swami. And, and we were like, you know, hugging each other and obeisances and trying to catch. It was like I was there standing on the steps for about, I don't know, a minute maybe. He just started to talk. And all of a sudden, Satsrupa, who was Prabhupada's personal attendant at the time, comes running out. And he's like, look, you know, coming towards me with this sense of alarm. He says, Bharadwaj, please come away. Prabhupada wants to, there's something he needs to tell you. Please come back. Some say, okay, Devananda, you know, excuse me, I have to go. Prabhupada's calling me. We'll talk later. And I was, you know, literally, maybe a minute and a half I was there. And I'm running back into Prabhupada's quarters. And, which were at the end of this long walkway. And, you know, I'm running in and, you know, come into the room, I pay my obeisances. And I look up and Prabhupada is looking at me very sternly. And he says, so, we have discussed so many things. You have so many things to do. I don't think you have any time to stand around and talk.
Prabhupada wanted Indians to get involved in every aspect. He didn't just see them as people who could give money, although a lot of the gentlemen that he was dealing with were businessmen, but a lot of sadhus came to him also, a lot of very religious people. And Prabhupada himself was, before he took up the life of a sadhu, he was an aristocratic gentleman, and he moved in that circle. And he was, you know, these were principled people. So there was one man, Mr. Bridgeton Mota, who was a very big industrialist, and he was also the husband of the daughter of the leading Birla, which was the biggest family in India at that time. So this man would regularly come and sit with Prabhupada and listen to him, and he would chant a little bit of japa, and he would give Prabhupada advice on. And Prabhupada would listen very carefully to his advice because he was a good businessman. And throughout the construction of the Bombay Temple, of course, we spent a lot of money, and invariably, of course, we made a few mistakes here and there and got cheated. So at the end, when it was time to pay all the final bills and deal with all the contractors, because you've got to, you know, go over the contract, go over the work done, and see actually if there was any cheating involved, etc. To our amazement, Prabhupada turned everything over to Mr. Mota, gave him the final authority on who to pay and how much to pay and how much to cut. And of course, he saved us a lot of money. So I think there were many examples like that. In his writings, Prabhupada talked about the construction of Bombay Temple, and he wrote a letter to Giriraj about Sumati Morarji and told him that just form a committee and give the charge of building the temple to the members. He said, our business is preaching. We should not get entangled in these mundane business affairs. The members are, they have invested in us, and we're investing our preaching in them, so give them responsibility.
Prabhupada seemed to be very fond of George, and philosophically interested in John. They had many philosophical exchanges. George is a very down-to-earth person, still now. We were just together about a month and a half ago, and it's like any friend of yours, very, again, like Prabhupada, not self-conscious, open. And Prabhupada was able to surmise that. So they had a very friendly and respectful. But it was very friendly. George also was friendly and respectful to Prabhupada. And they were talking about addiction. As someone may be addicted to drugs, that we are addicted to Krishna. Now, it was interesting at the time, John and Yoko were totally or somewhat addicted to heroin when we were living here, too. We didn't know that until, I didn't know that till later, but it was interesting that Prabhupada, again, reading minds. Now, sometimes, if you're just speaking eternal truth, it will cover a situation. But Prabhupada seemed to be able to read minds. Now, after that, basically it was about growing a taste, a love for the chant and for the philosophy. It was quite nice the way he was doing it. It wasn't judging or asking too much about them. He was talking about as if an artist, when they get in what's called in the zone, where it's meditation, it's actually it's a trance state. When things disappear and you become involved so much in what you're doing that everything else disappears. And that's what Krishna consciousness, that taste, the chanting. So that's what he was preaching.
Said Aravinda was... His disciples were so enamored of his greatness that they were like fog. They didn't know what to do. He said when he passed away, when he died, they didn't know what to do with him. They thought he was in samadhi, and so they left him to sit there. He said. Until he began to smell. He said, so did not have intelligent disciples. He said, his disciples didn't know the difference between the living man and the dead man. He said, what is the use of a disciple like that? Less intelligent. He said, you should never criticize the, you cannot criticize, he said, the other teachers. He said, you do not know. It is not your position. He said, but it's okay for you to criticize their disciples. You can tell them they're less intelligent.
Then we used to go out on morning walks in the vicinity. This was still in the suburbs of Paris. And one morning we were walking. I came down with a blood infection. I must have cut my foot. I didn't take care of it, and I had like a red streak up my leg. It was a sign of serious blood infection. So Prabhupada said, and he noticed that I was a little cold. You know, it was a little chilly in the morning. I only had a thin kirtan. So Prabhupada was asking me, how is your health? And I said, well, it's okay, Prabhupada. He saw I was limping, and he said, are you cold? And I said, well, not really. He said, if you want, he said, I will give you some clothing. So that was, you know, very considerate of him, that he was, you know, so concerned about myself, my health, and other devotees, too. I came down with such a serious infection, I had to go into the hospital. But right before I went to the hospital, we had a big program in the School of Architecture. And during that program, Prabhupada gave a speech, gave a talk about Varnashram Dharma and how people who didn't follow it were less than dogs or like dog-like. So when the question and answer period came, one gentleman stood up and he said, yes, Swami, I want to ask you a question. You know, with a French accent. He said, what is wrong with being a dog? So Prabhupada said, if you think it is good, then I give you my blessing. You can take birth as a dog in your next life. So, you know, when he said that, everyone, all the devotees gasped for breath, you know, because they realized the pure devotees giving this guy his benediction to become a dog in his next life. So that was quite an event.
He asked me if I could arrange a meeting with the ambassador to the United States, because I had already met him with some devotees. And he was leaving Delhi in 2 days, so he wanted to see if I could do it in a day, or do it before he left, and I was able to arrange it the next day. And so we went there and we took some devotees. I think we took Dinanath and Yadabara. Yadabara was a Peace Corps guy, so we could say he was in the Peace Corps and this man was in the Navy. We didn't necessarily say that he left the Navy for Krishna consciousness, but so it was like sort of like trotting the people up to the showcase. And but by this time we were friendly with him. He had already put me together with the Food for Peace people, and I was able to get many tons of food mixture that we could distribute. Unfortunately, nobody in India liked it because it was wheat soy blend mixed with sugar, and even the cows didn't like it. But that's a little bit of humor. But they gave us many tons, and he liked me, and so the meeting was arranged, and Prabhupada. They gave us, he asked if you'd like tea, and Prabhupada said we don't take tea, so they gave us warm milk in gold-rimmed American Eagle cups and saucers, and Prabhupada began to say that, again, that there are many, many separations, but these are not very important. Like, you may think you are American and that I... You may think that I am Indian or Hindu, but that in Krishna consciousness we rise above that bodily distinctions, and these can be changed. And he explained, you can change our name, you can change our passport, we can change where we live, change the country of origin. So these things are temporary, and we should not think of each other as that, because it only separates. So he says, just as I don't call you Mr. Stripe Suit, Kenneth Keating had a gray and white striped suit, and you don't call me Mr. Orange Robe. We know each other for something greater than that, and we don't let Mr. Stripe Suit and Mr. Orange Robe not be friendly towards one another. And then he said, just like I don't drink this milk with my elbow, and he was demonstrating that, and we all laughed uproariously. As it was, Kenneth Keating was so enthralled that he kept so many other ambassadors. They were doing a photo shoot on the front lawn, the front steps of the American Embassy, and the secretary kept on coming in and saying, Mr. Ambassador, the Swiss ambassador requests that you take a photo now. And he said, yeah, but then they were across from each other, he was looking. Then they would raise the ante. The Russian ambassador is being impatient. So finally, Kenneth Keating said that we have to bring this meeting from the sublime to the mundane. I have to go. And Prabhupada immediately said, I have to bring this meeting from the sublime to the mundane too. I want to meet your president, who was Nixon at the time. And so Kenneth Keating said that actually he had gotten that request before, and that Mr. Nixon really was not that interested in meeting anybody from India, but he would try.
Muralidhar was in that same predicament, you know, in that enigma. What do I know about Krishna? How do I paint Krishna, you know, this struggle, you know, the internal thing, and what's my qualification, and how is it possible, and what is, you know, how can I look at what I'm doing as a divine representation, and if I can't, you know, how will it be to somebody else? And so he asked, sitting in with Prabhupada in the room, and it was one of those rare times. I think it was in San Francisco, actually. And Muralidhar was just starting to, he was a newcomer, and was just starting to paint. But same thing, Prabhupada charged him with, you know, with work. And so he wanted to know. So he was sitting around, and Prabhupada looked. And there were many different pictures of Krishna, and you know, posters and calendar pictures and little things in Prabhupada's desk. And so Muralidhar was bewildered. And so, well, which one of the, and they were different. So he asked Prabhupada, he said, We have so many pictures of Krishna here, but they're all different. So, which one is most like? Can you direct me? Can you tell me which one of these is most like Krishna? And he said, and Prabhupada looked at him as though he was totally crazy. He said, I have never received such a clear message from anyone that I'm out of my head. He Prabhupada looked at him and he said, they're all Krishna. They're all Krishna. Each one of these is exactly like Krishna.
Prabhupada, I think that our temple can be maintained by doing a little business. So immediately he said, you should not do. And I said, why not? I said, because your business is preaching. You are brahmachari. He said, if there is a grihastha, and I said, yes, well, Lochananda. He said, yes, Lochananda can do. He is grihastha. He can do business. But you are brahmachari. Your business is preaching. So he gave me a very important instruction there, and I did follow that. And Lochananda did start the business at that time, and it helped the temple a lot. But Prabhupada was very firm about that point.
And then he told how his Guru Maharaj had gotten somebody to buy cigarettes for a visiting scholar from Germany. Yeah, I mean, he was open-minded. When I was in Russia, because there was a scarcity of food, he found out everything was the same in the stores. He said, you could even eat meat if you have to keep this preaching going on. I didn't have to, but there was things like that. So this was very interesting because it was Ekadashi, and he said, my Guru Maharaj on Ekadashi fed the quarter. So feed everybody. And he had us cook regular prasadam and still observe Ekadashi ourselves. But in other words, don't discontinue the prasadam distribution program. Don't discontinue it.
One time in Vrindavan, he was recovering after a long illness. Apparently, began to take his morning walks again, and the devotees were overjoyed to, you know, turned out in great numbers to walk with him, and then Prabhupada was feeling very inspired these walks, but he would come back from his morning walk, he was practically, you know, he's practically exhausted. He would be laying there for the rest of the day, but on the morning walk he was energetic. He would talk and be very animated and argue it, you know, be very strong. And so I remember one morning he said, how is this? He said, I can walk, and when I'm walking, I have the strength. And you know, here we are talking and walking and feeling strong. But when I get back, he was just thinking out loud. He said, well, I have no strength. I cannot move almost. I said, what is that? And it was the other devotees who became really thoughtful with him, you know. So, what is that? How is that? And Brahmananda said, it's transcendental. Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada looked at him for a moment and said, yes.
When the deities were going to be installed, and we had secured a new temple in Paris on Avenue Foch, I had purchased some very expensive perfumes, natural oils, like natural jasmine oil that's, of course, maybe $10,000-$12,000 a kilogram. And I bought all these precious oils in smaller quantities for the installation of deities. So when Prabhupada was, when Radharani was being bathed, Prabhupada applied some perfume on her face and her body. And then all of a sudden, he stopped. And then he asked for yogurt, because the perfume must have, some way or other, reacted with Radharani's skin, and it created a slight blemish on her face and on her cheek. So for the next 20 minutes, Prabhupada bathed her cheek with yogurt. And I felt very bad about that, that I had, I had purchased that oil. And he spent a long time bathing Radharani after that, and looking at her, and kept looking at her cheek, and, was very attentive. I don't know how that happened, but, there was he was so attentive, and all the devotees noticed. He just kept putting yogurt there and looking at it and putting more yogurt like that.
We were at Gaurachand Goswami's house for lunch, and he asked me, "What do you think of Gaurachand Goswami?" And I said that I think that he loves you. He's a rascal, but I'm fond of him. But he is a rascal. Prabhupada said, "That is how I feel." He has invited us to have lunch prasadam. We shall go. So we're there, and again, Prabhupada was sliding different chapatis, puris, sabji on my plate. He just kept on feeding me like that, all bitten, which I thought was great. And so then I would slide it on somebody else's plate so they could share in the nectar. So then Gaurachand Goswami, he was smoking bidis. We used to sometimes take them when we were doing our parikrama of Radha Damodar Temple. So he would, because he'd say, "Where are my bidis?" And he'd yell, and we'd watch him getting excited, like the thief who used to be a thief and asked his guru. I like the response that you get from that people when their things are stolen. So the guru said, "Just put their luggage in other rooms," and then they had the response. And then he said, "My dear Prabhus, I was a thief and I can't do that anymore. I'm a Vaishnava, but I just wanted to see the response, and here's your luggage back." So Gaurachand Goswami at the end of the meal wanted to have a bidi. He couldn't see. He was actually almost totally blind. So we went behind the door and had a bidi. The only thing it was, he wasn't behind the door. He was sitting in the front of the door in kind of a sneaking view. And Prabhupada was eating, so then I said like that, and we had a good laugh because it was really obvious. He was trying to sneak and there was smoke all over the place.
So I saw how he freely gave of his time to them, and he would listen to their problems. He would even, that was the wonderful thing, he would even talk about their family problems. He would talk about, petty things. And then, he would encourage them to come more often to the temple. Or, for example, Dr. Patel, one time Dr. Patel was sick for a few days on the morning walk. So Prabhupada got very concerned. "Where is Dr. Patel? Somebody please call him, find out what's happening." So, overall, I was in Bombay for many years. Then I became the president of Calcutta. And there also I had a lot of opportunity to, actually more so in Calcutta, to be trained almost by Prabhupada. And I saw him working with the Indians. And gave a whole new perspective to my understanding of how big Prabhupada's plan was in Krishna consciousness. It was, not some type of just cult or something, but he had an idea of a nation or an internation of Krishna conscious people.
I asked Prabhupada that Gaurachand Goswami is in the Goswami family, but he doesn't want his son to eat prasadam with us. And Prabhupada said, "Yes, that is a distinction. You can find out how they really feel about us in Vrindavan. Invite them to prasadam. And if they come, they are for us. And if they don't, they are not." And it was one of these little etiquette things.
After finding out that I spoke another language, he said, he talked about the creative service, the artistic services, and he said, "This you can do, no matter what language you speak." these images just to paint Krishna. He said it. This speaks to anyone, anywhere in the world. It brings Krishna directly into their heart and into their mind. He says, this is not unimportant. This is great service. You should be convinced of this. So, you know, the artists were beginning to feel more easy about, you know, the pressure that was on them to stop painting and go out and distribute books, because there was that anxiety about not being good enough. You know, are these people, they can only just sit there and paint, you know, second-rate citizens. But Prabhupada said, no, he said, this is actually very important service. Sometimes you can think of it as an even more important service because it is not restricted. You have to translate into so many languages. It may be a good translation, maybe not, but this, he said, this is direct preaching. He said.
The dancers wanted to go be accepted more, and the book distributors were recognized, and the dancers and thespians were just like there. And so they asked me what to do. So I said, well, let's have a command performance for Srila Prabhupada as he comes in to the L.A. compound. They came in, and they had costumes, and they did it on the lawn, some Bharat Natyam type dancing and stuff. And then Prabhupada saw me, and he called me over to the car, and I said, the dancers and theater people would like to do a command performance for you. When would you like it? He said, tomorrow. So they did it in the temple. And as it was, I think Prajapati played Baladev, and somebody else smaller played the Pralamba demon, and Prajapati was, they were falling before he even had a chance to dispatch him. And they were clawing a cloth on the edge of the temple, and I looked over at Prabhupada, and he was laughing. So the next morning, we're in the BBT warehouse, and Ramaswara's talking away about, well, these are the books, and these are the books. And this is one of the times Prabhupada was reading minds, I guess, because he said, where's Prajapati from that performance? And of course, he wasn't on the walk. He wasn't a big gun, so somebody ran to get him. So when Prajapati came, Prabhupada said, let us distribute these Krishna conscious arts in every town and village, just like the books. And so they were able to go to India, and it was an affirmation for something else, that if your inclination was not to stand in a Kmart, maybe you still could be valuable.
There was a devotee whose name at that time was Patitu Dharan, tall and lanky and very individual, much of an individual. He danced in his own way, he talked in his own way. He, in short, he was unconventional in many ways. So, he obviously didn't fit into that narrow category of, you know, book distributor. So he, obviously going on in his own mind, some dilemma. So he said, he's, after a nice big kirtan and temple, Prabhupada gave a lecture, and then all of a sudden he said, are there any questions? So he comes out of the blue, he said, Srila Prabhupada, we're all here, he said, I'm paraphrasing, he said, we're all here eager to hear what will please you. We want to do what is most pleasing to you. We've heard so many, you know, there's so many different types of service is dear to you, and some, as you have said, is more dear. Will you tell us clearly what is most dear to you? And Prabhupada said, just chant Hare Krishna and become simply wonderful. eat Simply Wonderful and become simply wonderful. That is all. Hare Krishna.
When I was the president of Calcutta, again, Prabhupada had his office, and he would meet his disciples there, and I was the president. Theoretically, I should be, you know, sitting right at his feet and be the center of everything, and, you know, sharing and hearing all the nectar and everything, but I was always very shy. And I thought, let me go out and make more members. Prabhupada's here, I should make an extra effort. But what I did get a chance to see by being kind of in the background or on the outside was that Prabhupada also had all his senior men coming there, and he had his Mayapur Vrindavan fund, money that he would give out. And it was very, very interesting to watch how the leaders, such as, you know, Jayapataka Maharaj and Bhavananda and Tamal Krishna Goswami and Giriraj Swami and Guru Das from Vrindavan, and they would all come, and Prabhupada, he didn't pick a project that he wanted to favor as much as he would look to see how much the devotee was enthusiastic about his project and how much he was prepared to organize it and manage it well. And on that basis, you know, he would allot funds. So it really depended a lot upon the enthusiasm in the individual for a particular project. And I think Prabhupada, again, I think Tom Hopkins in the World of Hare Krishna video, he noted how Prabhupada would tell someone, go out and start a magazine, and the devotee never knew anything about a magazine, and he would say, Krishna will help you. I kind of saw that also, that he really just would look for enthusiasm, look for a spirit of depending on Krishna, and he would reciprocate and respond to that.
So Prabhupada saw Krishna in everything. He said that if Govinda slaps you, you accept it as mercy. It was during the Pakistan-Indian War in Delhi, and some people were saying, now we have blackouts, and you're not putting the lights out, and aren't you afraid? And Prabhupada said, we're not controlling, you cannot even control your toothache, your stomachache. So he said, but what if the bomb should come? And Prabhupada says, if the bomb comes, I will see it as Krishna.
Then another time, we were in a car coming from the airport to the temple, and I told Prabhupada that we were thinking about renting a store and calling it the Krishna Shop. Prabhupada said, no. He said, call it Hare Krishna Shop. He said, let them say Hare Krishna once in their life. And then he told the story of a Puranic story of a man who was charged by a boar, a wild boar, and he screamed haram, haram, which means untouchable, dirty thing, and at that point he died. The boar, you know, injured him and he died, and Prabhupada said he went back to Godhead because he said haram. Now haram means untouchable in Urdu, or, you know, whatever language was spoken at that time. But because it approximates the name of God, because he said that, he went back to God. So Prabhupada said, this is how powerful the holy name is. Therefore, call it Hare Krishna Sat. Let him at least walk by and see the name of Krishna and say it. So it was very, you know, I was very, you know, pleased to hear that. And when we did open something up, we called it Hare Krishna Sat.
But, you know, most of the time people did not tell Prabhupada the full story. And one other thing, since I'm thinking of it, when they did, Prabhupada always wanted to rectify it right away. He didn't want to let it fester. For instance, I was, the people from Hawaii, who weren't initiated at the time, Siddhasarupananda's folks, came to New York, and I had already hosted them in London, and they wanted to buy some books, over $300 worth. So I said, sure, I sold them. So the next day, someone told on me, to Prabhupada that he had sold those books to the people in Hawaii. So Prabhupada, like many times before, got all the parties together. And he said, I'll give the name because it's personal rather than slandering. He said, he looks at me and says, Bhavananda, I said, you have sold over $300 worth of books to the people in Hawaii. And then he says, they're reading my books? And he does a mock thing like that. And they are chanting the holy name? And Bhavananda wanted to crawl under the cushion. So what I liked about Prabhupada is rather than backbiting and this kind of thing, he get all the parties together, bring it out in the open. This was done all the time. People would get read. Oh, such and such says that you're... Da-da-da. So, I like that very much.
And this was in the last few days of his life, actually. Unknown to me, of course. I kept thinking there was... Prabhupada was going to blow us away by just all of a sudden, you know, one day, just saying, okay, it's, you know, okay, enough of that. You know, I'm back to full life. So he, that particular morning I started, oh, it was, he had stopped my harmonium playing the day before, so I was shy. I didn't know whether I should play it again, because I didn't know why he had stopped me. I just thought maybe that the sound itself was somehow annoying, irritating. So then I would just chant without harmonium. But then on that particular morning, I ventured one more time to try to play the harmonium. But this time I played a tune that I hadn't played, that I hadn't heard for a long time, I hadn't played for a long time. But it was one of the first sort of unusual tunes that Prabhupada had recorded. It was recorded a long time ago somewhere, either in Boston or New York or someplace. And it was this Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Very unusual and soulful, can't place it in any particular cult. You know, it was just spontaneous, something that was just Prabhupada's own unusual sound, where it was coming from his heart somewhere. And so that morning I began by playing that tune. I don't recall Prabhupada stirring at all. I mean, there were days when he was just completely motionless. Couldn't even tell that he was awake or asleep or what. Just motionless. And he had been fasting for months now. Months. I mean, just living on little water and pomegranate juice, occasional something, but really fasting. And but yet every day he would set aside some time for dictation. Even if he couldn't sit up, they would hold the microphone, you know, to his mouth, and Prabhupada would continue dictating the translations and purports of Srimad Bhagavatam. Kept on going. But that morning, he was motionless. It was early morning hours, and suddenly I looked up, he had motioned to one of his attendants. I think it was Nanda Kumar at the time. So Nanda Kumar or Shruta Kirti. They asked him, or maybe it was Giriraj. They took turns to ask, and yeah, but he wanted to sit up. He sat up, and as I was chanting it, he began clapping his hands like this. It was like it was slow motion, but it was very definite, right on beat, and he would nod his head in approval. It was such a reward, such a wonderful thing. You know, it was like, it's hard to say, it was like, I don't know, it was the best reward I could have asked for. So that tune is, you know, is a very, very special weight, you know, for me.
Sangshara-dava-nanda-nirandu-okam Nanaya-karuna-ghana-ghana-tyam Vapta-chakal-nana